Welcome to the Who, What, Why podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Scheckman. If we were to distill the essence of today's headlines into a rich reduction sauce, the primary ingredients would undoubtedly include war and the ethics of war, artificial intelligence, technology, money, politics, and most of all, Silicon Valley. These elements form the core of Andrew Coburn's latest investigative piece, featured on the cover of Harper's Magazine, entitled The Pentagon's Silicon Valley Problem. It tells the compelling story of the intricate intersection of technology, defense, and the ethical quandaries reshaping warfare in our contemporary era and the role of the leaders of Silicon Valley. This even reaches into AI. As we grapple daily with the implications of AI on education, employment, and autonomous vehicles, we may be overlooking one of the most critical areas where AI's influence is rapidly expanding, the shadowy domain of the military-industrial complex. Here, the integration of artificial intelligence into defense strategies and tactics represents not just a matter of technological advancement, but a profound ethical and strategic puzzle. Coburn delves into the pressing questions surrounding the effectiveness, ethics, players, and potential consequences of this technological fusion. In essence, he asks, what are the broader ramifications for all of us from Silicon Valley's increasingly intimate relationship with the Pentagon? Andrew Coburn stands as a formidable figure in journalism and currently serves as the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. His distinguished career spans several decades, during which he has authored impactful works and reported extensively on national security, defense policy, and the complex geopolitical forces that influence global stability. It is my pleasure to welcome Andrew Coburn here to the Who, What, Why podcast. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, not at all. Good morning to you.
Well, it is a delight to have you here. Certainly, the involvement of technology in Silicon Valley to some extent in the military is in itself nothing new. It goes back even to the Vietnam War, as you talk about in the piece. Set that context first.
Well, yes. I mean, Silicon Valley, to use the shorthand term for sort of digital tech, I guess, was really the creation of the defense complex, of the defense machine, going back to the electronics industry in World War II, maybe, but certainly the semiconductor revolution, which was very much spawned by the Defense Department, by defense contracts. And then the internet itself was, you know, started life as, well, its precursor to the internet was ARPANET, which was a product of the Advanced Research Projects Agency, a Pentagon offshoot. Going further down the line, Google search, Brin and his partner, their crucial work on their search technology was funded while they were stunned by the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of, you know, Google Earth, again, a program called Keyhole, which was basically a CIA program. So it's never, you know, they've never been poles apart. In fact, they've been very close together. But there was a time in the 70s and 80s, with the dawn of the personal computer, when there was a feeling that this was something different. We were getting away from, you know, government-dominated, you know, high tech, militaristic high tech, and this the personal computer was liberating, which indeed it was. And you know that we had our own now. You know, information was accessible, universally accessible, and freer. So we thought for a while at least. But now, as I talk about in the piece, I mean tech, Silicon Valley, and the Pentagon are locked in an ever tighter, almost seamless embrace.
And AI is, of course, artificial intelligence, a big part of this. And while the public may think of AI, at least in the popular imagination, beginning somewhere around November 22 with the launch of ChatGPT, the involvement of AI certainly goes back much further, and its involvement with the military goes back further.
Oh, yeah. Well, the military has longed for AI, you know, forever. They've had, you know, AI task forces going on for at least well over a decade, as far as I can remember. Because the military they've long pursued the dream of being able to, control everything with a machine, that somehow all information can be fused and interpreted for them, sort of tell them what to do, which is, shows how uninterested they are in war, really, because war, battle, the battlefield is all about menace and uncertainty and all that. But anyway, so they, and the example I quote in my piece, I say a decade, I should say half a century, because during the Vietnam War, story I love because it was the precursor to so many things, during the Vietnam War, they concluded, wrongly as it turned out, that the Vietnamese fighting in the South absolutely depended on supplies coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail from the North Vietnam through the jungles of Laos. Actually, most of them were coming through by sea through and then through Cambodia, but never mind. So they said, well, what we have to do is to fence off that, to interdict that flow of supplies. And to do that, we'll set up an electronic fence of, scatter thousands, tens of thousands of sensors across the jungle. And each of them was there to detect various signs of human activity, like, footsteps, sound of feeling of traffic disturbing the ground, or the ignition spark of engines, or human urine, the ammonia smell from human urine. And each of these sensors, there's a little radio transmitter, which was beamed up to aircraft circling overhead, which in turn transmitted that information to giant computers in a secret base in Thailand, the most powerful computers then in existence, which were meant to analyze all these information coming from the different sensors and say, we detect a Vietnamese column in such a place. And then aircraft, and including drones, would go and attack it. Well, it was a complete bust. The Vietnamese figured out what was going on in a week, actually, and took steps to decoy it. They would run herds of cattle of sort of ways away from the trail, so to fool the sensors that the troops were over there. They'd hung buckets of urine in remote areas, so they would think they were there. It just didn't work. It cost billions and billions of dollars and was a complete bust. But the military never gave up pursuing and investing in AI. Well, this is proto-AI, but the idea of computerized fusion of information until we get to today. I mean, I won't take up all your time with the many failed projects, and they're still failing today.
And bringing it up to the present in terms of failures, the Israelis were using AI as a defense protection on October 7th. That didn't work very well either.
No, they'd proudly, just a few months before, the head of Shin Bet, their internal security intelligence service, had proudly announced that, we've now got our own AI version of ChatGPT, and it can tell us exactly what the terrorists, meaning Palestinians, are doing, where they are, every motion and action they take, and that'll tell us what he's going to do. That'll enable us to predict the future. And of course, it didn't, because it's all absurd. These they've obviously fallen into the notion that, like the military here, and like so many other people now talking about AI, that AI is a thinking machine. It's not. It's on a vast scale, it assembles information and sort of sorts it and comes out with a probable conclusion. But it's not thinking. And so, in case of the Israelis, not just AI. AI they ignored. AI was giving them the wrong conclusion that Hamas would not attack, and they ignored, what they did ignore was all the very obvious signs that that Hamas would attack, including Hamas's own videos, which they were putting online, showing them practicing breaking through the fence and attacking settlements and taking hostages and all the rest of it. So AI just got them nowhere.
Yet in spite of these failures, there is a large contingent, both in the Pentagon and has been for quite a while now, a contingent there and a contingent in Silicon Valley, a group of people that are pushing for a closer and closer relationship between Silicon Valley technology and the defense industry.
Well, what I think is, yes, that is what you say is true, you know, and certainly all the big tech firms are very eager and have been increasingly over the last, certainly over the last decade, to start leeching off the taxpayer big time. And I think what's going on is a couple of things. One is commercial tech. I mean, all the sort of wonderful gizmos they brought up, the smartphone, particularly all the applications and so forth. It's been argued to me that the scale, the pace of innovation has really slowed down in the tech industry. I mean, that's not completely true, but I mean, it's not across the board, but to a large extent it is. And so in that case, they look around and they think, well, where's a really, you know, if we're not going to be able to come out with a new whiz bang, you know, thing to sell, you know, not like, say, the smartphone, which changed everything. What's a really dependable source of revenue going far out in the future? Well, you know, the government, the taxpayer, you and me. So, you know, they've been very eager to, you know, they've all set up, you know, they've all started to go after defense business, and most particularly the cloud business. You know, they're all bidding. There was a very huge, bitter fight for the Pentagon cloud a few years ago between Amazon and Microsoft. Microsoft got the contract, a huge $10 billion contract, and then Amazon protested, saying Trump had unfairly tipped the scales because he didn't like Amazon. And then so eventually the Pentagon realized it couldn't afford or didn't want to antagonize, you know, the losing big tech firms. So they've now parceled it out and everyone gets a slice of the action. It's called a very unwieldy acronym, the Combined Joint All Domain Command and Control Network. And that's the idea. It's, you know, it's way back to like the Vietnamese fence, you know, which was called Igloo White. This is sort of, you know, great-great-grandson of Igloo White. It's the idea that all information can be fused and everyone participating in the defense effort in a war can have access to everything that's going on, which is, it would take another show to explain why that's an incredibly stupid idea too, but it is. So, you know, what we have therefore is now a big lobby. You know, they have, the tech has become part of the military industrial complex, and there are various unsavory signs of that, like the eagerness now of retiring senior officers, you know, 3- and 4-star general officers and below, to make their way west to California and get sign on with a venture capital firm or a tech startup, you know, the revolving door, so they can sell their contacts and access them, you know, they can lobby therefore and, you know, help themselves to, they hope, a huge payday, because they've all, you know, they want this idea that you know, you work in tech, you become a billionaire. So you've got a lot of greedy retired generals and admirals who are hopping on the gravy train. And you know, the ideas that are coming up, most of them are perfectly stupid, you know, the sort of ideas that I just read in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago, that the venture capital is pouring money into hypersonic research. They're going to produce hypersonic weapons. Well, first of all, research into hypersonic weapons is incredibly expensive because you need all kinds of specialized wind tunnels and so forth. And secondly, no one's ever managed to make it work. They say the Chinese and the Russians are way ahead of us, but when you look closely at the Russian one, what the Russians claim is the hypersonic weapon, the Kinjal being used in Ukraine, it's not that. I mean, it just goes very fast, but the whole idea of hypersonic, without boring you with the details, is something that goes super fast and maneuvers, so it can't be shot down. Well, the Russian thing, which is actually an aged missile, sort of upgraded and renamed, doesn't do that. And it's unlikely, there's been any years now failed tests by by Lockheed, for example, trying to get one to work, and they failed. So how some bright-eyed young entrepreneurs from Silicon Valley are going to accomplish it, I don't know. But they'll certainly get a lot of money out of the Pentagon.
And talk about the push for this within the Pentagon. There was a lot of effort in bridging this gap between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon during the Obama administration with high-ranking Defense Department officials like Michelle Flournoy and Robert Work. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, they were, you know, within the Pentagon, there's been for, you know, forever, but more and more these days, you know, a love affair with high technology. They love high tech because, well, really, there's money in it. You know, they may not be directly profiting, but the whole impetus of the Pentagon has been to develop ever more complex weapons, which means, you know, ever more contracts for a whole bunch of people, which invariably are sort of overambitious, because of how they sell them. You know, we're going to have a stealth plane that can also be a fighter plane that's also a nuclear bomber, you know, to name but one concept. And then and the trouble is that these things always cost more than projected. So you end up with less than fewer things, whether planes, ships, whatever, than you originally projected. But instead of saying, well, maybe we should do it another way and go for simpler concepts, they say, no, we need more, even more high complex things. So therefore, it's not surprising. A mainspring of this line of thinking was an office in the Pentagon called the Office of Net Assessment, which was run by a guy called Andrew Marshall for years and years and years. And he would always come up with grand intellectual concepts, which, as it so happened, gave a justification to the military for buying more complex weapons. The Chinese are ahead of us in precision weapons. We need more, you know, something even fancier to do this, the guts. And people like Robert Work came out of that stable. And, you know, Flournoy, she didn't actually work for Marshall, but that's the sort of abiding doctrine in the Pentagon. If you want to get ahead, that's what the way you have to talk, because that ultimately is where the money is. And the people who, you know, the industry, the whole complex, the military industrial complex, you know, exists to generate more money for itself. That's its purpose in life. And so, you know, these people, the people you mentioned, Work and Flournoy, and there are many others, you know, rode on that. And therefore, it's natural that they would sort of sing the song of, you know, to Silicon Valley innovation and the wonders of tech, and they can solve all our problems. And by the way, get themselves fat advisory, you know, consultancy contracts along the way.
And talk about the other side, the push on the Silicon Valley side with people like Peter Thiel and Palmer Luckey.
Peter Thiel, you know, he made his initial money out of what, PayPal, I think.
Yes.
And then he had this idea that, you know, that he wanted to be part of the military-industrial complex. So he set up Palantir in what, 2003 or 4, I can't remember, around then, which was basically a data sorting firm. I mean, to use, it came out of the technology, the fraud detection technology they developed for PayPal, and it could, you know, analyze patterns, which is what AI does, you know, the essence of AI. I mean, so it's always been pursuing that. Never actually made much money for a long time. But he then later on, in what, 2013, 2014, along came Palmer Luckey, who's kind of a prodigy. I mean, he developed the Oculus virtual reality headset when he was, I don't know, 17 or 18, and sold to Facebook, to Meta, for, I don't know, several billion dollars. And then decided he was, you know, that he really, by gosh, knew a lot about defense and knew what needed to be fixed and knew what he could do with all his technological brilliance. And so with Thiel's backing, he set up this company, Anduril. And he's obviously a very smart fellow, I suppose. But the sort of defense ideas or defense technology he touts, because he sounds like absolute nonsense. You know, he wants to, I quote in the piece, his dream of a superhero soldier, the soldier of the future, who will be equipped with the technology to know absolutely everything that's going on around him and where the enemy is exactly and you know, which hill the enemy is hiding behind and what his commander wants him to do and what he should do next, which I'm afraid from practical expression in a defense program, you know, blessed by the Pentagon, which actually went to Microsoft, called IVAS, the Integrated Visual Augmentation System, which is a super goggles, and, you know, plus a battery, plus a computer that the poor old infantryman has to lug around, and which is supposedly going to sort of make him, give him all the information he needs about the battlefield and how much ammunition he has and where his other, you know, comrades are and where the enemy is and what tree the enemy is finding behind and what his next mission is. Meanwhile, the poor fellow is, you know, trying not to get shot and trying to find a rock he can hide behind. So, and the soldiers it's been tested on have complained bitterly, but that doesn't seem to make much difference. And they're still going to have to carry around a 50-pound battery pack. And, you know, there's $23 billion of our money going into it. So, you know, I think, I mean, in the end, I see this whole fusion of eruption or inruption of Silicon Valley into the defense complex as meaning nothing good for defense or the, certainly the poor soldier who's going to have to use it.
And one of the other things that we're seeing is a pushback from time to time in Silicon Valley about the ethical issues surrounding this. We saw it several years ago at Google, and there are flare-ups from time to time. Talk about that.
Yes. You know, going back to what I was saying earlier about there was this, you know, dream for a while that, you know, that tech was different and was liberating and was, you know, the antithesis of the big bad, of Big Brother and, you know, the whole, you know, government machine and people like Apple, and they all said, we never want government contracts, you know, dealing with the government is horrible and they're a hopeless, soulless bureaucracy and, you know, we must prefer to operate light-footedly on our own. And that sort of feeling persisted in, you know, a lot of the workforce, people who wanted to work in tech. So when it emerged that Google was secretly working on a contract for something called Project Maven, which was going to use the wonders, really the sort of basically the wonders of search technology to be able to analyze video footage, you know, data, but initially video footage taken by drones, prospective, you know, enemy areas, and would be able to analyze it, you know, without human intervention to say, aha, you know, the enemy tank is there or the enemy is doing something else over there. And that was Project Maven. And when that leaked out, that we just had a secret select team working on it, when that leaked out to the broader workforce, there was an explosion of protest. And people said, you know, you know, the motto of Google was meant to be do no evil. This is evil. We don't want to work on weapons or weapons technology. And, you know, 4,000 people signed a protest and a few, actually a very small few, but still a few actually quit. Google apparently, you know, said, okay, we're sorry. We were, you know, okay, we've changed our minds. We'll give up that contract, or at least we won't renew it. And a couple of years go by, and then quietly Google bids on this thing I mentioned earlier, the joint all domain command and control. So they, you know, they were just as eager for particularly Pentagon cloud contracts as anyone else. Google feels that they've fallen behind Amazon and Microsoft in that business, and they're eager to catch up. So yeah, and I quote, you know, someone from a former Google person who quit just because he was so appalled at Google's behavior. Actually, because he quit particularly because Google, while I should to digress for a second, a lot of this is tied up with threat inflation, traditional threat inflation, you know, which is all part of the military industrial complex game, which is, you know, the enemy is drawing ahead of us. And so particularly the whole people pushing, you know, defense tech talk a lot about China and how the Chinese, you know, they're so smart and they're working so hard and they're drawing ahead of us in AI and everything else. And we've got to buckle to and, you know, work harder and spend more money and Hatshapu. And that was particularly true from the guy who had been head of Google, Eric Schmidt, and he's always talking about the Chinese threat. Well, then it turned out that meanwhile, they were working on a Chinese contract for the Chinese to develop a version of the search engine for China where you couldn't look up, you know, politically awkward things like, student protest or freedom of speech or anything else the Chinese authorities didn't like. It was a thing called Project Dragonfly. So I quote someone who quit over that, but it's just the hypocrisy that runs through the industry, it turns out.
Bringing it back to the early days of this, one thing that seems to be different is that in the early days of the relationship between technology and the Pentagon, when you talked about the Vietnam War era, and there were companies like HP and Raytheon and all these companies that were engaged with the Pentagon and ARPANET, that in many ways what the Pentagon was doing and the government money was driving innovation in technology. You don't get that sense today. There's much more of a sense that Silicon Valley is simply trying to sell their wares to the Pentagon, and that it is not a case of the Pentagon's money driving any kind of innovation.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they might argue that by the Pentagon, by pumping money into, AI or other things, that they are in a way driving innovation. But I agree with you. They don't. It's like, the great wave of innovation that swept through American industry and, particularly in technology during the Cold War, has really sort of died away. And all we're doing is sort of throwing more money at it. It's interesting. Why did this area of Northern California, basically the peninsula south of San Francisco, become the heart of this? Well, it was a fusion of, there was already, big defense interests there. Lockheed had plants there, for example. You had Stanford, the whole sort of intellectual, sort of mighty intellectual engine of Stanford University, into which a huge amount of money, government research money was being pumped. And you had, the people wanted to work there. You had the counterculture, people that helped, a sort of very innovative state of mind. I think that so many things came together. They always kind of reproduce that. I mean, there's a huge effort around Austin, Texas, where you have because that's a tech center, and that's where they put the Army Futures Command, which is yet another government effort to sort of leech off, tech ideas. Now there's no one center really. It's kind of around the world, but around the country. But I agree with your point.
And finally, AI seems to be becoming a larger and larger part of this. In your conversations, in your research on this piece, talk about the fantasies about AI and what the government hopes to do with it at this point.
Well, what they had to do, they hope to sort of, I quote a long paean of praise to AI by Michelle Flournoy, who's basically been a sort of, she is an arms salesman, actually. She's part of a thing called West Exec, which is basically a bunch of arms traders. But she says, AI is going to be able to, enable us to do our intelligence. It's going to be able to enable us to design planes better. It's going to be able to enable us to maintain our weapons better, plan production, which is all nonsense. And, they installed, actually 3 years ago now, then they switched on a big AI program in the Pentagon called Game Changer, which was meant to be able to tell them how the Pentagon works, the thousands and thousands of directives on what their policy on anything particular circumstance might be. And so this Game Changer is made to, rather than sort through, a mile-high stack of documents to find out what their policy should be about something, they can ask Game Changer, which will hopefully give them the right answer. But one of the things this Game Changer is meant to do is to tell them where their money goes and what they actually spend all their money on, because they don't know. because that for years they've been failing their audit. Even the Congress has passed a law saying they have to be able to pass an audit. And so they installed Game Changer in 2019, which is going to tell them where the money goes, and they're still failing their audit. So, you know, it can't even do that. And to top it all, the press release announcing Game Changer, they couldn't even, they said it was all, they wanted to say they're using authoritative sources, and they managed to spell authoritative wrong. So, so much for AI.
And do you think any of this technology is going to change the future of warfare very much?
Well, you know, warfare changes all the time. I mean, yeah, I mean, I've been blithely sort of condemning the whole thing. I mean, there's ways, you know, it can help with sort of pattern recognition if you know what patterns to look to ask for. I mean, you know, it's the old rule of garbage in, garbage out. So, you know, if it's properly guided, yes, it can help. If we look at Ukraine, you know, what has Ukraine taught us about the future of war? Well, you know, you hear a lot about, first of all, you should hear that, you know, what's really been the determining factor in Ukraine is artillery and how much either side has of it. And, you know, artillery has been around for quite a long time. The targeting has improved. So now, you know, artillery can be very precise, but so therefore, people are having to learn to camouflage themselves, another very old technology. The other thing that's made a big difference or seems very innovative is drones, but not sort of the super high-tech drones that we've been, you know, been getting all the publicity in the last 20 years, but cheap, mass-produced, you know, drones like you and I can buy on Amazon. And they're the important ones on the front line because individual soldiers can use their drone to see, you know, to scan the battlefront and see where the enemy is. And, you know, if their drone is armed, you know, crash the drone into the enemy tank or, you know, trench or whatever. So that's been important. But whether, I mean, AI, I mean, the technology in the end, yes, it'll make some kind of difference, but I can guarantee you not in the way that's being projected by Michel Flournoy.
And we should point out for our listeners that Michel Flournoy was Undersecretary of Defense in the Obama administration.
Well, that's right. And she almost became Secretary of Defense in the Biden administration till people pointed out her multiple conflicts of interest. And so they had to withdraw her name. But yeah, she's very much at the center of all this.
Andrew Coburn, his story in the current issue of Harper's is The Pentagon Silicon Valley Problem. Andrew, it is always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us here on the Who, What, Why podcast.
You're more than welcome. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on the Who, What, Why podcast. I hope you join us next week for another Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shechtman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.